I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Hearings continue today for John Bolton, who is the White House nominee to fill the post of U.N. ambassador. It got ugly at one point when a former State Department colleague called Bolton a kiss-up, kiss-down sort of guy. Carl Ford Jr., a former chief of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, added, "I've never seen anyone quite like Mr. Bolton. He abuses his authority with little people." Well, meanwhile, another set of hearings in another room in the Capitol building today. John Negroponte is the man chosen by the White House to become the country's first director of national intelligence. For a sense of how his hearings are unfolding, we turn to Walter Pincus in Washington, national intelligence reporter for The Washington Post. And Walter, briefly, give us an overview. How is it going for Mr. Negroponte?
Well, I think in contrast to the Bolton hearings, I think the Negroponte hearings have been pretty well easygoing, except for one or two interventions where his past in Honduras was brought up and questions about whether he covered over human rights violations there, and another time with Senator Levin about would he sort of talk about a policymaker who misstates intelligence in public.
Well, let's go to that first exchange, as long as you brought it up. Reporting in your paper, The Post, today apparently led to some testy exchanges this morning when, as you said, one senator tried to get Mr. Negroponte to answer questions about his role as ambassador to Honduras and charges that he was undermining the will of Congress by helping the Contras, who were undermining the Sandinista revolution in neighboring Nicaragua. Can you tell us a little more about that exchange and what your colleague Michael Dobbs reported today?
Well, what it's based on a series of chronology of then-Ambassador Negroponte's cables back to both the State Department and in sometimes to the CIA. And I think one particular cable talked about a policy which Congress had just ended, which was support, financial support to the Contras, mm-hmm. Some of which was spent in Nicaragua, where the Contras were trained to go back into Nicaragua, in which, as ambassador, he said it was a policy that he thought should be supported. Right. What the questions focused on is whether he was undermining the policy, and what he said in effect was he was just saying it was a past policy, but he said specifically that he made every effort to, scrupulously, he used the word, to abide by what the law was at the time.
Right. Was there any suggestion yet in the documents that have been revealed that Mr. Negroponte aided or abetted any of the death squads operating in Honduras or Nicaragua?
No, that was not the, it's never been the charge. The charge is he avoided mention of them mm-hmm. in his cables back and his analysis of the human rights activities in Honduras. Not that he was in any way supporting him. He was arguing whether the details about how much they existed and what they were doing.
So is this just going to seem to most as a sort of a rehash of an old scandal? Or?
Well, as two other senators said, they were brought, these things have been brought up first in 1999 when he was confirmed to be ambassador to Mexico. It was brought up again in 2001 when he was confirmed as ambassador to the U.N. He's fully aware of how to handle those questions. And I think right after the exchange with Senator Wyden, you had another senator raising a sort of a proponent of Negroponte saying, we've been through this in the past, and let's get on to the future.
Right. We didn't count how many times Mr. Negroponte used the word teamwork in the portion we could hear in his opening statement and elsewhere. But do you think, and with just the few seconds we have, of this, is this going to be his biggest challenge if confirmed? We have Donald Rumsfeld moving to set up his own power center in intelligence affairs.
Well, he was actually asked twice about the Defense Department and a memo that the Secretary of Defense put out saying that all defense agencies ought to work with Negroponte as the new DNI through Stephen Cambone, an undersecretary, and twice, not once but twice, Negroponte made it clear that under the law he could deal directly with three of the really major collection agencies that work in the Pentagon because he has authority over their budget. Mm.
Walter Pincus, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post at the John Negroponte hearings. Walter, thank you.
Thank you.
Have you filled your gas tank lately? The price of gas is breaking records for the fourth week in a row, with an average of $2.28 a gallon. That's 46 cents higher than the same time last year. With prices expected to soar to as much as $2.35 a gallon by May, people are looking for ways to save at the pump by turning to hybrid vehicles, popular because they're high on gas mileage and low on emissions, but also back-ordered at many dealers. And now Perry Stern of the online publication MSN Auto tells us the hybrid craze is starting to go from an earnest niche market to the mainstream, and a saintly image for car makers and drivers.
It's a halo vehicle, and it's what people want to be seen in, you know, because it shows that they're caring about the environment, and you know that's it's been very popular with movie stars now, and it's taking hold as something that you want to aspire to.
But some experts say hybrids are just a pit stop on the road to the next big thing, hydrogen-powered cars. General Motors and Daimler Chrysler have signed multi-million-dollar deals with the U.S. Department of Energy to develop new hydrogen fuel cell vehicles. The state of California is ahead of the game. Three cities are already testing hydrogen-powered fuel cell vehicles in their transit systems. Craig Ferguson drives one of them. It's called a zero-emission bus, or ZEB. It's used by the Santa Clara Valley Transit Authority in San Jose. And Craig, tell us, does the ZEB look just like a regular bus?
Yeah, it looks just like a regular bus, except has the writing on it, letting everyone know it's a zero-emission bus.
Yeah, and how does it handle? Any different from any other vehicle?
At first, it feels very top-heavy, like you might tip over going around a corner because of the fuel cells being on top of the bus.
Oh, yeah.
But after driving it for quite a while, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever, it feels like every other bus. They have the same power, if not a little bit more, than the regular diesel buses coming out from the bus stops, because we do a lot of stopping and going. And also look quieter, a lot quieter than the diesel buses.
Well, now, some bus drivers in Iceland who drive similar vehicles have said that sometimes when it's cold, they see white clouds trailing the buses. I don't know if it gets cold enough where you are for that, but have you noticed anything like that?
No, we don't get white clouds. We do get a white steam. It's actually steam, so people think it's white smoke coming out.
Yeah.
But, that's what's coming out of the exhaust.
It's really steam. Do you think these ZEBs, the zero-emission buses, are going to catch on?
It's particularly out here in California with, we try to have some clean air out here. And I think as the cost comes down, more people will get involved. And that's one of the reasons why you and I don't want to get behind buses and trucks, because typically you see the black smoke coming out of the smokestack, and none of us want to be behind that. So
normal bus drivers have to bring the bus back to the barn, you know, the bus barn, and it gets fueled up or whatever, I suppose.
Right.
What do you do?
Well, when I pull it in, they have mechanics actually fuel the buses, and they wear static suits so that there's no static.
A static charge could ignite
exactly.
Something?
Yeah, exactly. So that's, if it were to catch fire, it would be a real hot fire.
Mm-hmm.
At the plants where they do produce the hydrogen, if there is a leak, they'll use a straw broom to detect, put in front of you to see if it caught fire before you got to it, because you wouldn't see it, because the fire is white, so you can't see it.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
Well, we understand that a common concern that some people have voiced is that hydrogen-powered vehicles aren't safe. You know, there's a feeling that the hydrogen could somehow lead to an explosion.
Actually, a lot of drivers have felt that way. That's why a lot of drivers want to stay away from it.
Well, do you feel that way?
No, I don't. If I did, I wouldn't be a part of the project.
What convinces you that it's safe?
Well, due to the fact that hydrogen is lighter than air, and if it does escape, it'll go up into the atmosphere rather than coming down. And sort of like smoke detectors, the hydrogen detectors, so they detect a leak, I'll get an audible sound.
Hmm.
And they have some other safety features that if I were to get in an accident, it would shut the bus down immediately. And I know they've done a lot of testing. They've shot rifle bullets into the tanks, and they haven't ruptured, so that makes me feel pretty safe.
I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Craig, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Craig Ferguson drives a zero-emission bus, or ZEB, for the Santa Clara Valley Transit Authority in San Jose, California. And U.S. analysts are hoping that hydrogen-powered vehicles like the one Craig drives could someday reduce the U.S. reliance on oil, if some of those problems are taken care of. Well, joining us on the line to talk about the prospects for hydrogen fuel cell cars is John Wallace. He's a fuel cell car consultant. Welcome.
Thank you, Rowan.
And can you start by telling us exactly how the hydrogen fuel cells work in cars?
Certainly. In a hydrogen fuel cell, hydrogen is combined with oxygen in the fuel cell stack, and electricity is generated, and the only waste product is water.
And the advantages, of course, are?
Well, obviously, it's very clean. Fact is, a lot of people, you know, get a kick out of drinking the water that comes out of the tailpipe. The other advantage is it's very efficient. It uses much more of the energy in the fuel. And, of course, it is an electric vehicle, so you have all the advantages of electricity in terms of quiet and smooth operation.
Disadvantages?
Well, for one thing, hydrogen infrastructure is not available. It's not easy to find hydrogen. There's a few stations around. There's about 20 stations in California, and they're scattered around the rest of the country also. So that obviously is a problem. Even more important, perhaps, is the fact that right now fuel cell engines are extremely expensive. They have limited lifetimes, and there are some pretty severe technical issues in terms of trying to start the engine when it's below freezing.
But, John, is it safe? Some people worry about hydrogen exploding, and we just heard from a bus driver who said that when his bus is refueled, the mechanics have to put static repellent uniforms on.
Well, let me take those in two bites. Of course, people are always worried about hydrogen, and there's a, you know, the mental image of the Hindenburg is, of course, one that people use. But again, there's been a lot of studies done, and we were concerned that we would need to have special types of garages and so on, and we find out that it's really not that difficult to keep hydrogen safe. I think what you're seeing in terms of the bus driver and the bus refueling is a very young technology. And when you have a young technology, people are very, very careful. They don't want to have any problems. They don't fully understand the best way to do refuelings and so on. And so they tend to be a little extra careful.
Is this one of the costs of producing the cars, that they have to have extra protection?
Well, yes, that's true. We undoubtedly do have extra protection in these vehicles, and part of it's just not having enough history.
Well, how expensive is a hydrogen-powered vehicle?
Today, it's unbelievable to outrageous, depending on how you want to look at it. It certainly is above $1 million a vehicle, and but you're really looking at research prototypes, not commercial vehicles.
John Wallace is a hydrogen consultant. Stay with us. We're going to have more on the prospects and the problems with hydrogen-powered cars when we come back, including, you know, hydrogen isn't that energy efficient to use right now. And we're going to see how China is hoping to leapfrog over a gasoline culture by setting up a hydrogen economy. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today we've been talking about hydrogen-powered fuel cell vehicles, the next big thing, but also a technology in its infancy. One problem, while oil is a natural energy source in and of itself, hydrogen is produced from water. And right now that's a costly process that takes a lot of energy. Hydrogen is also hard to store and transport. As we just heard, if workers fear a leak, they wave bristle brooms in front of them to detect the invisible flames. But President George W. Bush has earmarked $1.2 billion to promote research into the area, and China may leapfrog the gasoline culture altogether and put all its efforts into developing a hydrogen economy. We've been talking to John Wallace. He's a consultant working with the Chinese government to develop a hydrogen infrastructure there. And John, why would China be interested in setting up a hydrogen-based fuel economy?
Well, as you may know, China has become a net oil importer, and that's a very troubling situation for China. They do not have large quantities of petroleum inside their borders. so they have to import much of their oil. Also, it's extremely polluted in the big cities, and they're also very concerned about that. But I think the key issue for China is they are really interested in new technologies. They have a long-term view, and they're very much desirous of being a big player in the world over the next 20 years. And they see that they have an actual advantage here in that they have not committed fully to a gasoline diesel infrastructure.
Mm. Well, and we read a couple of other factors that are fascinating. First of all, we're reminded of how many people live in China. And apparently, up until recently, people would never have dreamt of having a car. One worker in Beijing is quoted as saying, "I never thought of getting a car. Driving was a very serious profession, like medicine."
Well, and to some extent, it still is. And it would be the same as you imagining that you were going to have a private jet. As much as 10 years ago, that was the situation. And of course, it's tremendously changed now. There is a growing middle class, and they have the ability to purchase cars. And what we see now in cities like Beijing and Shanghai is the difficulties they're going to have with road infrastructure.
Meaning what? That they don't have the roads for the people who are getting the cars?
At this rate of growth in cars, you're not going to be able to move in these cities, and it's very difficult for them to build roads through these very dense cities fast enough to keep up with the growth.
Well, and we understand as well that with so many cars going on the road, you mentioned the emissions issues, pollution-related illnesses are going to suck up as much as 15% of the country's gross domestic product by 2030 at the rate they're going now. So China's looking for hydrogen-powered vehicles, and some Chinese leaders are saying they want to have 10,000 hydrogen-powered cars on the road by 2015. Given what we've just been talking about, how possible is that?
Well, I don't think that it's totally impossible. 2015 is 10 years off. That gives us time for two or three generations of work, and the Chinese have good capability in hydrogen technology. They are producing their own fuel cell engines. Certainly, they have a long way to go, but I don't think that's a completely ridiculous statement or anything.
Yeah, what would that mean? I mean, would that mean that they would, you know, it'd be like having, I'm thinking of 8-track tapes, which lasted for just a second, and then everyone went to, you know, CDs or whatever. Is that analogous to China sort of bypassing a gasoline culture?
They certainly did that with wireless and wireline phones. They kind of leapt over having the tremendous infrastructure of telephone lines that we have, and everybody has a cell phone. But I'm not sure that's completely viable. I think that if you look at the amount of time it will take to make that happen, that they won't have the option of not putting in a gasoline and diesel infrastructure.
Can you foresee when we will see hydrogen-powered cars in the U.S. at an affordable price and with people open to buying them?
I think that the auto industry feels that with sufficient work, and I'm not talking about just a few years, I'm talking about quite a number of years, that we can get the price of hydrogen engines down, that we can produce an affordable hydrogen vehicle. The key issue is this interaction between the vehicle and the infrastructure. It's the classical chicken and an egg. Nobody's going to put in a very substantial hydrogen fueling infrastructure, and that includes not just the service stations, but mechanisms for generating hydrogen and transporting it and so on, unless there are a lot of customers. And nobody's going to buy a lot of hydrogen vehicles until there's a lot of fueling infrastructure. And I guess my view is that we're not going to make that transition until we're really under pressure to do so, until oil is either so expensive or so scarce that we're just not going to use it to burn it up in our cars. Mm.
And John Wallace, again, a fuel cell consultant, just one last question, because I'm still hung up on the images we just heard about from our bus driver in California. Are Americans who drive these cars, as opposed to, you know, bus drivers or demo cars, when Americans start buying hydrogen fuel cell cars, are they going to have to don special, you know, static repellent suits to fuel them?
I think that we'll have, within just a very few years, the California Fuel Cell Partners has been working a lot on this, we'll have a fueling infrastructure that will not require any exceptional handling. Whether we're going to have people do their own fueling originally or have somebody that's trained to do it, I can't say. But we can get it to be much simpler. You're looking at an industry that has just been born. I mean, it's still in the crib. And we just have to understand that we're looking at several decades before it's going to be ready to start toddling.
Well, thank you for helping us look at it. John Wallace, a fuel cell consultant, working with the Chinese government now to develop a hydrogen infrastructure there. John, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Jerusalem as it could be. Strip away the political challenges. What would Jerusalem look like if everyone got along? That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Medical professionals in Angola are racing to stop the spread of one of the world's deadliest diseases. The Marburg virus has killed at least 194 people, most of them children. It kills, much like its cousin Ebola. People die gruesome deaths, bleeding from the nose or eyes, a week or so after coming into contact with the sweat or other bodily fluids of those infected. And there is no vaccine. Joining us on the line from the town of Wiege, where the outbreak is centered, is Dr. Michael Bell. He's consulting for the World Health Organization in Angola. And Dr. Bell, can you give us a status report on efforts to stop the spread of the virus?
Well, the current efforts, Robin, are focused in two areas. On the one hand, we're trying to ensure that the main hospital here is a safe place where both the personnel and the patients can be assured that they're not in danger. And then at the same time, the WHO team are working very hard to give good information to the local population, both on how they can protect themselves and also about what we're trying to do for them, so they're not overly alarmed by some of the efforts to both collect dead bodies and bring people into care.
Dr. Bell, tell us about that, because we understand that many Angolans are afraid of healthcare workers. I'm wondering, we've seen these head-to-toe suits that health workers have to wear. Those must, can you describe those? And then, you know, they must be difficult to see come into a village.
I think you're right. The garments that are worn to protect people who are handling dead bodies are substantially more than what we use in hospitals, because there's the possibility of a fairly decomposed corpse. So they end up wearing coverings that cover their legs, body, and arms, like a one-piece suit. They also wear hair coverings and goggles and, of course, masks to cover the nose and mouth. And because you can't see their faces, I think it can be even more daunting.
What else do health workers have to do besides remove the dead bodies? We understand you start with sterilizing everything.
Well, so these diseases do spread effectively from person to person by close contact with blood or body fluids. And the patients who get sick are often vomiting and somewhat messy. So, yes, it's true that the environment needs to be clean. In addition, we need to make sure that places like hospitals, where a lot of sick people come, are well protected, both by training the personnel to use correct precautions and supplying them with appropriate materials to do that. In the community, the mainstays of the response are to find all cases. So anybody who's sick and has an illness that fits the description that we're after needs to be identified, and then everybody who's had contact with that sick person needs to be found and visited every day for 3 weeks to make sure that they don't have a fever.
How difficult
is
that?
It's also challenging because places like this also have other reasons for fever, like malaria and dysentery.
And we're talking in many parts of the village outside of the very congested city. It's not as if you can track people down with computers. How difficult is it to find everyone? Do you think you're doing that?
You make an incredibly good point. It is a lot of work to drive from small cluster of homes to small cluster of homes. These are often very small dwellings in remote areas outside of the main township. It's a matter of hours and hours of driving around, asking where people might be, trying to find them, and keeping careful records of who's been found and who remains to be found. In addition to that, there's the problem that many people will hide, and because of the distrust in some cases, sometimes local neighbors and family members also won't divulge locations. So it takes a lot of convincing and a very persistent effort to find people.
Can you tell us, Marburg, we understand, again, a cousin of the deadly Ebola, a relative you don't want to have. Marburg was first identified in Marburg, Germany, after researchers working with African animals came down with it. Does anyone know how it's reemerged in Angola?
You know, the original source of not only Marburg but also Ebola virus has yet to be identified. In other words, we think that it normally is something carried by an animal host or perhaps an insect host, but which creature that is has yet to be shown. And so what we tend to see with both this and Ebola outbreaks is that there's an original insertion into the population. In other words, one person, either because they're traveling through an area that people usually don't travel through, or because they're foraging in an area that's not the usual area, for whatever reason, they come into contact with this, become sick, and return to their community. And then over the course of time, there's transmission within family groups usually, persistently until somebody ends up in a hospital. And what we see then is the level of contact that can occur in a hospital setting leads to a sudden outbreak amongst nursing staff, physicians, and students, which is often what raises the first flag.
Well, and that raises the question. One Italian doctor has already died from Marburg. There is no vaccination. You're not protected because you're a healthcare worker. You don't have any special inoculation. Are you afraid of this?
I don't think any of us take this lightly. I continue to exercise meticulous caution when I'm working in these settings. But using the standard precautions that we use, applying appropriate infection control that we use normally in hospitals, plus the extra care in the special care unit with special equipment to handle very sick patients, it can be done very safely. The problem is that during normal times in a place with very limited resources, there aren't abundances of protective materials and so on. Sometimes there's limited running water, sometimes there's no electricity. And caring for patients in a setting like that can be a lot more challenging.
And you are working in a country that's been torn by decades of civil war.
The infrastructure here has certainly been badly damaged by almost 30 years of warfare.
So, Dr. Mike Bell, what is your sense that this virus is going to be contained?
I think this will be contained. I think it's going to take some time. I can't tell you exactly how long. But it's going to take persistence with regard to tracking people down into the community, making sure that people understand how they can protect themselves. With regard to the hospital, I'm very hopeful that with the institution of some extra safety precautions, we'll be able to maintain reasonable care there.
Dr. Bell, just a last question. This must be a terrible disease to watch as a doctor. There's no vaccination. We understand that people are just isolated and you sort of hope that their immune systems can fight it.
It's very, very frustrating. Without something specific in terms of treatment, we're limited to supportive care, which in well-to-do settings can be fairly extensive, but in very resource-limited settings like this, there are significant limits to what we can do for people. We try to keep them comfortable, and most of all, we try to make sure that their family members are not being exposed unnecessarily.
Dr. Bell, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Mike Bell is with the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, but we spoke to him in Wiege. He's consulting with the World Health Organization in Angola, attempting to stop the spread of the deadly Marburg virus. Still to come, a new film looks at the global economy. The film's star, the laid-off American worker. You're listening to Here and Now. Scenes of protests taken by video vigilantes and the police at the Republican National Convention in New York City last summer are now being used to challenge official accounts of what happened. So far, video has been used to clear about 400 people arrested during those protests. And in some cases, the video has shown a stark contrast between what happened and what police had said had happened. Jim Dwyer has been reporting on the protest arrest for the New York Times. He joins us on the line. Jim, how has video been used to clear someone?
Perhaps the most dramatic and clear-cut case of that involved a man named Dennis Kine, the police officer who testified at his trial in December that we picked him up and we carried him while he squirmed and screamed. I had one of his legs because he was kicking and refusing to walk on his own. And then a video made by a documentary filmmaker turned up that showed Dennis Kine not being carried down the stairs, but actually walking plainly down the stairs under his own power, and ultimately there's pictures that show him walking right into the van where he was brought into custody. And so the case was immediately dismissed.
Well, let me ask you, though, at that point, Mr. Kine had his case had gone to trial, hadn't it?
Correct. He was actually the first of the 1,806 people who were arrested that day to bring his case to a jury trial. But almost everything has gotten dismissed.
Now, these videos have been used to help police prosecute other people.
Correct. There's been a small number, about 9% or so of the people who were arrested have actually been prosecuted successfully. And in a few of those cases, a few of those 9%, there has been some videotape used.
But it seems like for the most part, the tape is clearing people, including another fellow you write about, Alexander Dunlop.
Right. Dunlop had gone out for some sushi, so he says, and had plans to go to a movie. He had already bought movie tickets when he found himself in the midst of a crowd of bicycle riders who were circling the city that day and had come to a stop near his home on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And he suddenly found himself arrested. The police complaint said that he actually was part of a line of 100 people who had taken their bikes and shoved them into police officers, and when they arrested him, that he was flailing his arms and fighting vigorously or resisting vigorously. And actually, the videotapes, when they were finally unearthed, and they were police videotapes, showed that when he was arrested, he did not seem to put up any resistance at all.
In the case of Alexander Dunlop, wasn't it shown that the tape of him was edited?
Yes, the district attorney's office said that they had accidentally edited out these sections of the tape that showed Dunlop not breaking the law. And they said that when they realized what had happened, they immediately moved to dismiss the charges against him as well.
Well, did this lead to concerns that the tape may have been edited in other cases where people were convicted?
Obviously, it's the concerns by some people, and the police department and the prosecutor's office say that they're not doing that, that their intent is to give everybody the full picture of what happened. Given that over 90% of the cases have been dismissed or found not guilty, it doesn't seem like there's been a lot that's been hidden.
Right. And given that so many of the cases have been thrown out, what is the city saying overall about police tactics during that time? We all remember that you could be walking down the street to get sushi and suddenly there'd be a big orange fence rolled out and you'd be caught up in it and suddenly arrested. So what are, you know, has the city said anything?
What's the big take-home lesson out of all this? Well, it, you know, again, it depends who you ask. You have the folks who were arrested and some of the people who were with them who say, look, you were hyper-aggressive and hyper-technical, and you were doing these big shows of force and rounding up people who really were not breaking the law or causing any serious offense against public order, and you just wanted to show them. And the police say, look, we had hundreds of thousands of people in the city of New York that week. They paraded, they protested, they rallied, they had demonstrations. A lot of them were unplanned, some of them were planned. And for the most part, it came off without any terrible violence.
And I guess everybody learned that you will never again be able to have a large protest without pictures of it and video.
That certainly seems to be a big lesson of this event, that every, you know, there's a video in everybody's pockets practically these days. And I can assume that, you know, we walk down the streets now, somebody is watching and somebody will have a record of it.
Jim Dwyer, reporter for The New York Times. Jim, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Members of Congress are preparing to hold hearings tomorrow on the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. Supporters say the pact will support workers in countries such as El Salvador or Guatemala, who will in turn buy U.S. products. Critics say CAFTA will result in more outsourcing of U.S. jobs at a time when U.S. workers can't afford to keep up with rising costs even when they are working. The effects of rising costs, the jobless recovery, and the passage of NAFTA, a big sister to CAFTA, are explored in the new documentary American Jobs. Greg Spatz is the film's director. He spoke to us from the studios of Carnegie Hall in New York, and he told us the inspiration for the film came back in 2003.
Yeah, at that time, I realized that a lot of my friends around the country were either unemployed or underemployed. And I was reading in the paper about this terrific recovery from the 2001 recession. And in my little universe, I wasn't seeing it. I felt this kind of disconnect. I knew that my own little group of friends wasn't statistically, you know, viable as a sample. But it made me curious to see if indeed there were some structural rather than cyclical changes happening in the economy, meaning that some jobs were being lost that would never come back, even when consumer demand picked up.
And so you traveled to find out more about other universes, and one was in Kannapolis, North Carolina, home for years to a factory that closed. As the mayor said, it was like grandma was dying, and then she did. That factory was?
That was Cannon Mills. It was founded in 1906 by the Cannon family, who bought the land around the plant and built their own town to support the plant. It had been sold to a variety of different companies in the 80s and 90s. And finally, the last company that owned it, Pilotex, went bankrupt July 31st of 2003, which put 4,200 people in that region out of work.
It was a very patriarchal relationship between the town and the factory, much like many towns used to have with factories. I want to play a little bit from the matriarch of a family that you met. She worked in the factory. Here she talks about what she did.
I ran a jet sew machine. It cut the washcloths, it labeled the washcloths, it hemmed the washcloths. We inspected the washcloths off the machine, and then we repaired our bad hems. And we ran three machines, I did. Some of them run two, I'll run three. I loved it. It made perfect washcloths.
Greg Spatz, that was a very poignant moment. She took such pride in that washcloth. But wasn't it ever thus? I mean, you know, my grandfather's carpet factory left upstate New York. Shoes left Massachusetts. People forced to come up with new industries over time. New Hampshire, for instance, came up with high tech when the mills started closing there. What are you seeing that's different now?
Well, what's different is that we've created a new set of rules for the global economy that enable companies to globally source their labor. But these rules don't really protect labor anywhere around the world. We did do kind of a dress rehearsal for this when the Taft-Hartley Act in 1947 set it up so that some states could opt out of federal labor law. So we ended up with, you know, right-to-work states in the South that didn't have unions, and a lot of people closed down their northern plants and moved work to the South. So we had a sort of like two-tier regional wage structure in this country and went through all that dislocation. That's part of why the Rust Belt became the Rust Belt. So we've seen it before, but it didn't seem to prepare us for the much bigger shift that's happening now that all these labor markets where you can pay people less than a dollar an hour opening up, you know, in Mexico and the Far East.
You mentioned Mexico. NAFTA, the trade agreement, was supposed to improve economies in countries like Mexico so that people there would buy more American products. Here's former Representative Bill Archer from Texas.
NAFTA really is the ultimate win-win situation. Mexico will modernize its economy, buying machinery, products, and equipment from the USA, creating better jobs for its own workers. Its consumers will then spend their newfound wealth on everything from autos, refrigerators, and diapers made in the USA, creating better-paying jobs for Americans.
I went to Juarez, Mexico, which is kind of the maquiladora capital of Mexico. That's where a lot of the plants moved from the U.S. to Mexico.
Maquiladora being the name for the factories.
Yes, yeah. And it's a very, very poor and scary city to be in. You know, when I was down there, I certainly didn't see a new generation of sort of working class consumers. Who would eventually be, you know, wealthy enough to buy American-made products.
Yeah. We're talking about factory jobs, but you also explore high-tech jobs that have gone overseas. I'm thinking of the Boeing company. For the first time, a Boeing plane is being made with different parts, different composite parts making up the wing.
Yeah, you know, the wing design at Boeing used to be so proprietary that you couldn't take a picture of the wing if you went into a Boeing factory. Now, the next generation Boeing airliner, the 787, is going to be made out of lightweight composite materials like carbon fiber so that it uses less fuel. And this is the, like, cutting-edge technology in aviation. And Boeing is training the Japanese company Mitsubishi Heavy Industries on how to make an all-composite wing in Japan in exchange for Japanese airlines agreeing to buy the plane. And they probably would have bought the plane anyway. So we are really supplying the keys to the kingdom of future aerospace production to Japanese companies.
If the Boeing company continues with its outsourcing at the rate that it is now, it's writing the Airbus marketing plan for them. And the Airbus marketing plan in the next few years will be German engineering, made in France. Now, to counter that, Boeing will be able to say Russian engineering, made in China, and many other places around the world.
The people in your film point out that companies, and we always hear of Henry Ford, they used to, one of their main hopes was that they would create consumers who would then buy the products that they manufacture. And some of your participants in your film say that now companies are just out for themselves, not for the country. On the other hand, you know, there are people who say, well, if somebody has a really good offer and can give their stockholders a good return, why shouldn't they? And if you cut costs, you increase more consuming from the people who make money off your factory.
Well, ultimately, you know, my critique is with the system and the people who've designed the system. I think within any set of rules of the road, people are going to behave as a rational economic actor. The consumer is going to buy the products they want the cheapest way they can buy them. The companies are going to source their labor the cheapest way they can source it. But right now, the system encourages driving labor costs down to a minimum, and that will gradually, you know, reduce the number of good jobs in the U.S. and reduce the U.S.'s ability to consume. The implications are huge because, you know, China, Japan, Europe, every major country in the world depends on the American consumer to drive global prosperity. And so if we transfer enough work overseas to low-wage countries and erode America's income base, it will eventually erode the whole growth of the global economy. It's something we have to think about very carefully. But, you know, people making short-term decisions, you know, to boost the stock price next quarter aren't really worrying too much about that.
Filmmaker and author Greg Spatz, his documentary is called American Jobs. It's out on DVD. His new book is called CAFTA and Free Trade, What Every American Should Know. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Greg, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, my shoes, they come from Singapore. My flesh, that's from Taiwan. My table cloth's from Malaysia. My belt buckle's from the Amazon. Philippines, and the car I drive is a Chevrolet. It was put together down in Argentina by a guy making 30 cents a day.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.